Hello and welcome to episode 35 of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and this is another international edition, this time featuring Martin Malkesson, Chief Operating Officer at the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences. Martin is the first Swedish COO I've talked to about stuff here, and we learn firstly about his 10 years at SLU and his broad-ranging role covering all non-academic matters at the university, before hearing about a career journey which saw him starting out as a budding academic at Uppsala University and then becoming a teacher before converting to university administration. Following 11 years in various roles at Stockholm University, Martin applied for and successfully landed the job at SLU. SLU is notable for being Sweden's longest university, a very unusual title, with really significant distances between the three main campuses, but a number of other large and remote agricultural sites too, all of which creates some distinctive practical management challenges for senior staff. We also talk about the pandemic response at the university, noting some of the challenges of teaching, learning and assessment, especially with practical courses, but also the significant impact on students. Martin is confident that SLU has come through the pandemic in good shape, but development activity has paused and there remain concerns about lots of people wanting to work from home, whereas the university is aiming to rebuild the sense of community for staff and students, which does require people to be present. There are many similarities between higher education in Sweden and in the UK, but also some significant differences, not least in the generosity of research funding, student fee arrangements, and property ownership, which Martin helpfully explores. Finally, we look at the future of Swedish higher education, where Martin is optimistic about how things will play out, before we hear about a distinctive aspect of SLU's activities, its operation of a research ship on behalf of the Swedish government. It's a really informative and interesting discussion, and I hope you find it enjoyable. Welcome everyone then to the latest edition of University Registrars Talking About Stuff, and this time it's my enormous pleasure to welcome Martin Malkesson, who's Chief Operating Officer at the Swedish Agricultural University. I've got that right, that's the translation, isn't it, Martin?
Sort of, it's Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences actually, but right. You've got the point.
Right, so slightly imprecise on my part, for which apologies. So, no. Martin, you're Chief Operating Officer there. Yeah. What does that actually mean? How long have you been there, and what actually does your job cover?
Well, I've been here for about 10 years now, and as a COO or head of administration, I'm part of the senior management. You know, there's a number of rectors or vice chancellors with different roles, and then there's the COO who forms sort of the central management team at the university. And my responsibility, of course, is to make sure that the administrative services of the university work the way they should. And it encompasses a lot of different services. You know, in Sweden, organizational tradition pretty much is that anything that's not academic is sort of thrown into the lap of the COO. So I do pretty much everything. I mean, we've got, budget and strategic planning and accounting and real estate and faculty offices, usually belong to the central administration as well. IT, human resources, all that kind of thing. So it's a fairly vast a number of different tasks to deal with, you know. But I mean, it's the role, I think, is similar in most countries. But we don't actually, you know, I think perhaps in Britain and on the continent, people tend to sort of split the responsibilities, line management responsibilities between more people in the senior management group. So you would have one of the rectors or so perhaps being responsible for strategic planning offices and things like that. But in Sweden, you usually let the registrar do most of that line management, so to speak.
Which I wholeheartedly applaud, Martin. I think it's absolutely the way it should. But it is, you're right. I mean, it is there aren't many of those unitary whole administration jobs left, certainly in the UK. There are a few, but the trend has been to divide them up, partly because of the scale, diversity, challenge and complexity of institutions means that it's very hard really for one person to get an overview. So you've been there about 10 years. How did you end up there? What's your career path to get there?
Well, actually, I'm a historian by trade. I have a PhD from Uppsala University. Like everyone else, I wanted to be a professor of history at Uppsala University. That was my plan. But I pretty soon realized that, there was one event where we had this guy coming in to discuss career planning with us when I was still a graduate student at the Department of History. And he said, "And of course, you all want to be a professor of history." And there were about 25 of us. And we all said, "Yes, of course." And I realized that there were about three professors of history at Uppsala University. And we could not all become, professors. So from that on, I started thinking about doing other things. You know, not all PhD graduates need to work in the academy. So I started looking for jobs when I graduated, but I ended up as a teacher at different university colleges in Sweden for a few years, and then I applied for a job at Stockholm University as a planning officer or a regular sort of administrator at the planning office, and I did that for a few years, and I really liked it. I never regretted leaving academia, as such. Yes. Because it's, it's difficult to subsist financially and everything. So I always liked the job of being an administrator. And then I was promoted to head of planning at Stockholm University after a few years. And a few years later, I became deputy registrar or head of administration. So it sort of rolled on from there, and I spent 11 years at Stockholm University, and then I applied for the job here at SLU, as it's abbreviated in Swedish, and I actually got it, and I was quite surprised, actually. I thought I was a bit young and I didn't have enough experience and so on to take on the job, but I got it, and I've been here ever since,
Yeah, so clearly a track record of success over the decade, proving them right in their judgment that you were ready.
Apparently. I always think, 10 years, I must have, done something right, at least. They would have thrown me out otherwise,
Absolutely. And as our good friend John Hogan, who's just is about to retire from Newcastle in the next few weeks, often said after he'd been in his role for about 10 years, he said that, it's all my fault now. There's nothing I can blame on my predecessor.
Yeah, I had this terrible experience when I was new, actually, because the university had constructed several, new buildings at a devastating cost. And there really hadn't been any discussion on how to divide costs between faculties and who was supposed to pay for all this. And I ended up, early on here at SLU, there was a huge row at the university about this. And it was all in the local newspapers. And I thought, wow, is this what the job is like, But it was quite special, But at that time, I could blame the fact that I was new, I wasn't involved in any of the major decisions they had been taking before I came in. And so they could actually, the heads of the department could actually, they were very mad with the senior management, the vice chancellor, the pro vice chancellor, and they could say, this is your fault, and this is your fault, and it's not your fault, Martin. Because they knew I hadn't been there for very long yet, but he, John is right, of course. Sometimes you look at dates when something fishy turns up, and you look at the date and you see, okay, so was this before or after I came to the university? But after 10 years, there's not a whole lot of things that
you could... It's pretty much all down to you. Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
So SLU, the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, as now I will remember it forevermore. So tell me a bit about the university, because one of the things I noticed, I mean, you've got three main sites, haven't you? And they're miles apart. And I think on your website you say you are Sweden's longest university, yes. Which is a bizarre thing to claim.
That's true. Yes, we have, we're an agricultural university. So we do research in, you know, forestry, veterinary medicine, agriculture, of course, gardening, horticulture and things like that. And we're the only university that does that direction, so to speak, in education and research. And yes, we're split across the country. I usually say that, if Uppsala would be, let's say, Vienna, then the northern campus in Umeå would be about Berlin, and the southern campus in southern Sweden would be Venice. So imagine having a university split between those cities. It's quite a challenge, really. And then there's another probably 10 major sites where we have staff working, and numerous sites where we have forestry and we have our own estates where we do farming and stuff all over the country as well.
Well, yes, and we'll say a bit more about that as well. Yeah, I'm really interested in the level of property management that you must have to do as well.
Well, Swedish universities normally don't own their own properties. You know, we rent them from academic housing, which is a government corporation, so to speak. But SLU, as such, has its own real estate division. So we're the only university that can actually, you know, we own government property, and we are able to work in a bit like a real estate company, actually. So we have land, and we have farming facilities that the different faculties will rent from the university. And that's quite a challenge, actually, because it's, you know, we always argue about the level of rent and things like that. It's quite a challenge. But I would say probably over time, the most difficult challenge has been this division on different, the fact that we are split all across Sweden, because there's all kinds of, Uppsala is sort of the central campus. You know, we're like the Serbians of SLU. And then you have like the... In Umeå and in the southern parts of Sweden, in Alnarp, they're always nervous about being shut down and and being moved to Uppsala, to the central part of the university. And there's a lot of history back in time at SLU. And also, it used to be different schools once upon a time, before 1977. Wow. With different traditions and cultures and everything, so it's always work when you're in senior management to sort of keep things together, and try and mitigate any conflicts about where we should put new research facilities and so on.
So how does that work in practice then? I mean, do you all meet on a Monday morning together physically in a room, or is in fact everything done, your kind of management arrangement, is that all done online all the time? I mean, how does it work?
Well, both things. I mean, online mostly now, over the past 2 years, of course. But normally, the deans for the faculties are, scattered across the country as well. So we have two deans in Uppsala, and then one dean in Umeå and one in Alnarp. But we normally, before the pandemic, we met in Uppsala usually once every 2 weeks. So that, that's a way of keeping things together. And sometimes we would move around, and the entire senior management, including the deans, would meet in Umeå or somewhere else. But you know how it is. I mean, deans always are, they tend to be quite protective about their own faculties. You will have that sort of problem in a way, even when everyone is in the same spot. But it's sort of, it becomes stronger when everyone is geographically scattered across the country, obviously. And that is a challenge. But usually it's actually been quite smooth over the past 5 or 6 years, I think. It kind of depends on the attitude of the vice chancellor, how much he or she wants to keep things together, and how much he or she is ready to listen to the what the deans actually want, and so on. So there are many, many sort of relations that need to be taken care of here.
And that's the same everywhere. But I was intrigued the sheer scale of those distances that you describe. Yeah. That feels to me like a unique challenge. I mean, we've got campuses in Malaysia and China, but that feels slightly different because you're not trying to meet with them every fortnight in quite the way you describe.
No, but it's I think with the pandemic, it's actually become easier in a way because you. You know, when you have Zoom meetings, you don't make there's no difference between people, where they are and so on. So that's actually created sort of a sense of belonging more than it used to. But still, that's not going to be enough now that the pandemic is sort of over. Well, it's not over, but still, because people expect at least the senior management to travel around. You know, it's not enough to say that. Let's have a Zoom meeting. You have to move around as a vice chancellor or a registrar.
Yeah. So on the we're coming out of the pandemic. Of course, it's very easy to declare that the pandemic is over, particularly if you're a politician. But I mean, how was it for the university? Because everyone had challenges. We learned to cope in different ways. Online learning in an agricultural university, I imagine, presents particular challenges. I don't know how did it play out for SLU.
Well, I think all in all, it's actually worked out for us. In March 2020, we started a crisis committee, of course, like everyone else, and that committee has worked. The major problem all along has been teaching and learning, of course. Research has sort of worked pretty well, actually. I mean, you have problems with people who have to spend time in labs or things like that. But and actually, the researchers have become more productive. They're writing more articles. They've done that over the past 2 years, more than ever before. I don't know. I suppose they have more time these days. But the major problem has been teaching, of course, and how to organize that. And it all depends on the different subjects. But as you say, an agricultural university, there's a lot of, clinical training for veterinarians, for example. They have to be in the university animal hospital. And also other kinds of training, such as forestry. They have to work out in the forests where they have different types of exams and so on. Examination in general, of course, that's a problem for everyone. You can't put 200 students in a room to write their exams. That has been a problem, and we've done that online, and which means that a lot of students have cheated. Which is a problem, of course, for us. It's a general problem, I guess.
Yeah.
So, but all in all, it's sort of worked out. It's more a question of, I think, the mental health of students. All of a sudden they haven't been able to meet, and I think that to me is the biggest issue. All these young people who have come in and finally they're leaving home, they're leaving mom and dad to finally move somewhere else, and it turns out that they can't do that, and there are those that actually have moved to Uppsala or Umeå. They've been locked up in their student dorms and haven't been able to leave the room and so on. I think that's terrible. I mean, that's a general problem as well, I think.
I absolutely right, and we've certainly seen that all over the UK as well, and it's been one of the, you know, the striking features of the various waves of the pandemic has been that impact on students who have felt it really hard. As an institution, though, I mean, it sounds like, and I'm not putting words into your mouth here, Martin, it sounds like you feel pretty confident that you've come through it in as good a shape as you could.
I think so, yes. And I think the challenge now, of course, is to, you know, look forward and see. We express it in, we try to say that, you know, try and take the positives with us now that we are sort of hopefully coming through the pandemic. I mean, how do we use digital tools for teaching in the future when there's no pandemic? Yeah. You know, you can at least try and use that. And of course, you know, working at home, that's going to be a feature in the future as well. You know, if you look at administrative services that I'm responsible for, there's a lot of people who want to continue working home, at home. And how do you pull that together? You know, how do you, we noticed when we analyzed our economy after last year that, you know, we always have means for development, administrative development, and those means had not been used last year. There's no development work going on because people aren't in place and all the regular operative services work. But developing things, that's the challenge. And there's a very, very strong pressure, I think, from many people, at least in administrative services, to work home quite a great deal. And, you know, how to pull that one off, I don't know how that's going to work, but it's a challenge.
It is. And, you know, again, in the UK, many universities facing exactly the same thing. And, of course, there are people within professional services who've had to be on campuses the whole time, right? You know, your kind of security staff and your, you know, some of your residential staff and, you know, some of your library staff. They've had, and technicians, you know, they've all had to be there, haven't they? They haven't had any choice. They can't decide, oh, I'm going to work at home for 3 days this week, can they?
No, they can't. And that's also an issue. I mean, you know, we're discussing this in the administrative management group now. How are the heads of administrative department going to go about, because there are people, you know, the how would you put it, the people who run the different IT departments or accounting departments, if they want to spend time sitting at home, that could be a problem, of course, because, you know, when your boss is not around, why should you be at work? And I think it's important for our management team to stay together and to actually meet, preferably on a daily basis. And I think people are going to have to think about what they're doing, you know, because our coworkers are going to be watching us, you know. And I've stated quite clearly that I'm going to be at work. That's the way I like to work. And I don't have a long journey to go here. I mean, it takes me 15 minutes to go to the university. So it's quite natural for me to spend my time here. But we're going to have to see how it works out. But I think there's a certain pressure on management people, you know, to not sit at home too much, at least.
No, I agree. I mean, it's not about just being present, right? It is actually also about engaging with your colleagues, being seen to be part of the university. And of course, you know, part of being at university is being at university, right? I mean, you know, we're not just an online provider. We're a community of scholars and staff who are, you know, trying to come together to do interesting things. And you've got to be together to do that. And go to your point about mental health with students, it's also the kind of mental health issues with staff, which is if you're on your own the whole time, right, you don't engage with other people, you don't get the support and encouragement and, you know, energy and, you know, debate that you need from other people.
No, I think I agree. And that's actually been my point when I've discussed this with my management team, that, you know, we don't know about the long term effects of people sitting at home. I mean, mentally, for example, you know, I mean, some people seem completely at ease with, you know, not seeing any other person at work. And I can be, you know, it somehow irritates me sometimes. I mean, do people don't want any working colleagues anymore? Are they going to spend the rest of their lives sitting in front of a screen at home? What is this? Was it all a big lie? You know, what people actually wanted was to spend all their time sitting in a room in their apartment or house. I don't know. But I think interaction is one of the most important things. You know, that's how things happen many times, particularly in you know, academic departments, but also in administration. And also you get a lot of tricky issues like, when your colleagues aren't available, and you want to ask things and so on, you have to get on the telephone or you have to book a Zoom meeting to do something that normally would have taken 50 seconds to do. So you don't get the communication that you actually need to move things forward. I think
You completely agree. And also, you know, we are universities, aren't we? Right. And, you know, there is something fundamental about a university, which means that it involves people coming together. Right. And, and creating a community. And you can't do that all remotely.
No. And I think we've had a discussion about teaching here. You know, when you look at the teachers, some of them actually seem to be, you know, they like sitting home working because they won't be disturbed and so on. And in the end, you might end up in a situation where the teacher actually sits at home and the students are at campus. And I think that's ridiculous. How's that going to look? You know, you have a bunch of students sitting in a room and then the teacher doesn't bother to come in, but he or she actually chooses to teach from a screen. I think that would be, I hope we're not going to go in that direction, at least.
So in the UK, in that scenario, we have lots of, we have our government ministers telling us we must teach face to face. There is no alternative. You must do it. And in a very, you know, unhelpfully directive way, and, you know, you kind of think, well, we want to do that. Right. And we will do it. But we're also exploiting blended learning where it's appropriate to do so, because we've learned those areas in which it works really, really well. So please stop telling us how to blooming well teach, you know. Thank you Minister. But the other experience we have, of course, is that students in the UK who take out loans in order to pay their fees feel that if they're not getting that classroom experience, that they should be refunded some of those fees. Now, you don't have that quite the same way because of the funding position in Sweden, but you do have international students at SLU, don't you? And they will complain, presumably.
Yes, there's been, but they are so few, so that's really not a big issue. But there have been international students saying this, you know, why should I pay these huge fees when I'm sitting in front of a screen back home in Pakistan or somewhere? And I can understand them, obviously. I mean, you don't get the same quality, of course, when you're, I mean, it could be a complimentary thing, you know, when you, it's quite often today you see teachers actually recording lectures so the students can watch them anytime they want, and that's a quality thing, I think. You know, it's that could be that's not too bad, but students need to meet, I think, and that's I sound awfully conservative when I say it, but I think that's just the way it is. I mean, if you're a student, meeting during and around lectures is part of student life as well. You know, you don't want to meet just when you have a smaller seminar or something. I think it's important for students and for researchers to actually meet physically. Otherwise, you're not going to get the same effects.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I completely get it. And we've seen all exactly the same things in the UK. Coming back to SLU, there was a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about SLU, because I was looking at your kind of the data about the university. It looks on paper, and tell me if I'm wrong, you have a lot in terms of staff numbers. There seem to be a relatively large number of staff relative to the student population. Yeah. Is that fair? Is that because That's of the research fair. Activity and the nature of the operation?
Yes, and we sort of like to turn that around and say that we are a research heavy university, right. Because that's sort of high status. But I think we want more students, and you know, private business and people who work in agriculture and forestry are quite keen that we should increase the number of students because they are needed. And we want to increase them. But this is the thing about, you know, SLU has always had a fairly steady number of students coming in, and lots of them have been sort of very Swedish with parents working in agriculture and so on. So it's been a steady inflow of students with that background. But they have decreased over the years, and that's a problem for us. You know, fewer and fewer people are actually employed in the green sector, as we call it in Sweden. So we have problems recruiting students and actually maintaining that number of 4,000 or 5,000. It's increased now during the pandemic because there are so many young people who don't know what to do and they have trouble finding work. That goes for all universities in Sweden. But the goal is to increase the number of students. It's just a history thing. It's looked like that for a long time at SLU, and we have a very large number of people with the title researcher, for example, and not that many teachers or people working in teaching. The great number are actually researchers, and you know, we have this environmental monitoring task as well. So a large number of people actually work, and you know, we follow the situation in Swedish nature and in the lakes and so on, in the forests and so on, and report to the government. So that's more of an administrative task that we have, but quite a lot of people work in that field as well at SLU. So yeah, more students, but we are in a way similar to KI, Karolinska Institute, who also don't really have that many students. And those students are very expensive, of course. You know, they have medical students and so on. So
yours are much cheaper, you say?
Well, actually, no. You know, we always argue about what a student should cost inside the university. And those of us who have worked in other places, like myself, for example, know that the cost of a student at SLU is way higher than it is in many other universities in Sweden. You know, veterinary students and things like that. So we're quite well off. We're quite well funded, actually, in education. But actually, don't tell anybody I said that, but that's the way.
Yeah, you just did.
And also, of course, Swedish universities are in a phase now, have been for a long time, where we have, you know, we're all very well funded in research. You know, we have huge surpluses year after year. And I know we've discussed this in the registrars group or in the network. You know, we have a problem actually spending money. We don't spend enough. So many universities actually sit on huge amounts of research funding.
I remember you raising this before. So we have regular meetings every 2 years of Swedish and UK registrars, at which we share common issues, which is absolutely fascinating, which is where we met Martin. But that issue of you know the piles of research cash, you know, to UK colleagues, that just seems absolutely extraordinary. You know, there are many similarities between Swedish and UK higher education, but that really isn't one of them.
No, I think the two major differences are that one, and then the student fee, the tuition fee.
Yeah.
Because that's not a big bother for us, you know. But you often have that issue.
It drives lots of things. It has lots of consequences for the way we operate in the UK. And I think the third thing, which is also the interesting divergence, is the issue you mentioned at the beginning, which is the kind of property ownership issue in the universities in the UK. You know, although they may have borrowed to build things, effectively own their estate, whereas most Swedish universities don't. And so that is a creates a difference.
Yeah, and I discuss this with my colleagues sometimes who don't actually own their own property, and because there is a vision among many registrars in Sweden that everything would be much better if they owned their own property. And I try to tell them, you know, it's not all perfect and so on. It's actually quite a challenge to handle your own property because it's going to create a lot of, you know, deficits, of course, particularly if you own, you know, farming estates like we do. It's going to create conflict. You know, I'm always arguing with the deans about the level of rents and things like that. And they don't want to do anything. And we say we have to maintain the buildings, otherwise they're going to cave in. And there's all kinds of things, you know, going on. And I think my colleagues don't really see that. They just see how great everything would be if they could own their own property.
Yeah.
So I try to be a voice of reason in that discussion sometimes.
Yeah, but I think it, you know, these are things that happen over many, many, many years out of different traditions. And looking at it from outside, it looks like your model works for Sweden, right? The context that you're in.
Yeah, I've always argued that it actually works. You know, we have discussions with the companies that we rent from. And academic housing is the biggest, you know, it's actually designed to organize property for the Swedish universities. But all in all, the model is actually quite fine because it allows the senior management and the university boards to focus on education and research and things like that. You know, we don't have to sit around discussing maintenance schedules and things like that. I don't actually know how it works in UK universities, but at least we focus on you know what we're supposed to do, and I think that's a good thing.
I can absolutely get that. One kind of broad final area that Martin, before we finish, is so we talked a bit about, you know, coming out of the pandemic, and we talked a bit about the differences between Sweden and the UK. What's your view of the future of Swedish higher education then? I mean, how do you think the sector sits in Sweden? How does it look? You know, because you mentioned, you know, you don't have many international students. That's commonplace in Sweden because of the changed fee arrangements a few years ago.
Yeah.
But do you think that number will grow? Do you think, you know, there will be more, you know, global activity by Swedish universities? What do you think the future holds for Swedish higher education?
Well, I think in that regard, yes, I think the number of international students will grow, but I don't think it will be a very strong growth because all in all, you know, there is a language impediment here that most Swedish universities teach in Swedish. And if we teach in English, it's actually quite poor English sometimes. You know, Swedes have this vision of themselves as, you know, we are excellent English speakers, but
you're brilliant.
I wouldn't say that, but on average, I think, you know, we're not at all as good as we think we are. And so that's going to be a restriction, you know, in terms of getting more international students. I think we're a very long way from having regular programs taught in English, for example. So, But all in all, I think the sector is actually quite well off, as it were. I mean, as we were talking about, you know, research funding, you can say whatever you want about the government in Sweden, but irrespective of what majority we've had, Swedish politicians are quite keen on, you know, pouring money on us. We could do better in when it comes to, you know, undergraduate education, but all in all, we're quite well off, and I think we're going to keep going in that direction. So, and it's all right now. The big question, of course, is how are we going to work and teach once the pandemic sort of settles?
Yeah.
And of course, I think right now, I mean, in Sweden, we are in a situation where people are actually starting to forget about the pandemic. It's really. You know, the newspapers really don't report any numbers anymore about casualties, and that kind of thing. So, and when they stopped doing that, when the restrictions were removed, it sort of disappeared from the general, debate and everything. So,
that's great. One other thing, I noticed you've got a ship management department in what's that all about then? Do you have ships? Do you have a fleet? I'm imagining, you know, kind of a load of long ships, but that's probably just me being fanciful.
No, it's a research vessel formally that SLU and the Swedish Weather Authority. I don't know what the English word would be, but it's financed by the government. It's about 70 meters long. And it runs on the Baltic Sea and also sometimes westwards. And we use it for measurement of fish, the number of fish in the sea, for example. And it does temperature measurements also to study climate change and things like that. But it's a cooperation between us and the Swedish Weather Authority, and also we don't actually run all the stuff ourselves. We are formally the owner of the ship, and so it's kind of fun to have it, actually. You know,
so surely that makes you technically the captain, or at least the admiral, or something. You must.
Yes. Yeah. Well, actually, it was a funny thing, you know, when the government told us that you need to take on this ship, you know, and construct a new large research vessel and own it as well and run it. We said that we don't really know how to do that, but it worked out very well, actually. You know, it was built on time, on budget, and it's working now. The only problem, of course, are diesel prices, but we'll figure that one out, I think, in the end.
I'm intrigued to hear about that. Well, listen, Martin, thank you ever so much for your time and for talking and engaging so open. It's been lovely to hear. First ever time I've spoken to a Swede on the podcast, so I'm really grateful to you for that. It's been super. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education, comment and fun and games. Until next time.